From the Bluegrass States and the Derby City, this is Coast to Coast AM. Thanks to you, America's number one late night talk radio program. I'm Chris McGill, sitting in for the vacationing George Norrie, and it's both a pleasure and an honor to be here with you once again. This hour, I'll be talking with Bob Lytak, a man who claims he is the spirit of the real Santa Claus. Really? It's a fascinating story that you won't want to miss. And coming up next hour, Encounters with Angels. Author Joan Wester Anderson will share with us fascinating true accounts of angelic intervention in people's normal, everyday lives. Do these encounters prove that there really are heavenly beings here to help us? You be the judge. That's all coming up next hour. Now for some quick headlines of the day. A Midwest airline flight finally landed safely late Tuesday night at Boston's Logan International Airport. The plane had landing gear problems and circled the airport for about 2 hours before being able to land. Sparks were reported coming from the area near the right landing gear as the plane touched down. Flight 210 had 86 people on board and 4 crew members. Luckily, nobody was hurt. Transportation in New York came to a screeching halt today as over 30,000 transit workers went on strike. All subways and bus lines were shut down in the early morning hours, leaving millions of travelers to find alternate ways to get around, not to mention total gridlock on the streets of the Big Apple. This is the first such major transit strike in New York since 1980. That particular strike lasted 11 days. Mayor Michael Bloomberg says the strike could cost the city upwards of $400 million a day. City officials say they will seek some court actions to stop the strike, which was brought on by disagreements relating to new hire benefits. A federal judge in Pennsylvania ruled today that intelligent design cannot be mentioned in a Pennsylvania public school district. According to that judge, Dover area school board members violated the Constitution when they ordered that their biology curriculum include the teachings that life on Earth was produced by an unidentified intelligent cause. This policy is believed to be the very first of its kind in the nation and was adopted in October of 2004. The National Transportation Safety Board is now saying the seaplane that crashed off the coast of Miami Monday did so because its right wing fell off. The seaplane, which takes off and lands in the water, was on its way from Miami to the Bahamas when witnesses say it broke apart in the air and crashed into the ocean within view of horrified spectators on nearby beaches. Investigators say that stress and corrosion are among the main reasons they believe the wing detached from the 58-year-old plane. All 20 people on board were killed. And some scary news today out of New Mexico. Several hundred pounds of high-powered plastic explosives have mysteriously disappeared from an engineering company outside of Albuquerque. It appears that blowtorches were used to break into the storage containers that housed those explosives. Now, this is leading police to believe that the thieves knew what they were after. Officials say the amount of explosives would be enough to match the bomb that brought down the Oklahoma City Federal Building in 1995. Now, the real bad news, they have absolutely no idea who may be behind the theft, and alerts have been sent out to all federal buildings in the state of New Mexico. And Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon went home from the hospital Tuesday, just about 48 hours after suffering a mild stroke. Doctors say that a blood clot caused that stroke, but medications were successful in dissolving the clot away. He's expected to make a full recovery and is running for a third term as prime minister. Those elections are to be held in late March. Coming up, the story of the trial lawyer from Wisconsin whose personality and lifestyle completely changed after putting on a Santa suit for a community holiday event. The story of Bob Lytak, one you won't want to miss, is coming up. I'm Chris McGill, filling in for George Norrie, and you're listening to Coast AM. Bob Lytak received his degree in law from Marquette University in 1970 after completing his undergraduate studies in economics and marketing. For the next 10 years, he practiced extensively in the corporate sector and at one time serving as general counsel to a Fortune 300 company. Now, as a private practitioner and a member of a number of professional legal societies, he continues to direct his professional efforts towards litigation, focusing primarily on matters related to corporate law and family law and children's rights issues. Now, being, as Bob freely admits, the poster boy for every bad lawyer joke ever told, he was most certainly the least likely candidate ever to become Santa Claus. However, from 1978 to 1990, on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce for Cedarburg, Wisconsin, Bob found himself magically trapped inside that red and white suit. During those 12 years, Bob underwent a true Scrooge-like transformation of heart, mind, and soul. Bob Lytak, welcome to Coast AM.
Good evening, Chris. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to chat with you this evening, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, too. It's a pleasure to have you here. Now, I read your book today, Reflections of a Small Town Santa, a true story about Santa Claus. It is a fascinating book. Tell us first how you became Santa Claus.
An interesting story. And some years ago, I was establishing my practice in Cedarburg, Wisconsin, which is a delightful Courier Knives village just outside of metropolitan Milwaukee. It's a Christmas card in the flesh. And the Chamber of Commerce usually requires people to participate in some type of event when you set up shop in that little town. And as it turned out, the local Santa Claus for the Visit with Santa Claus, which was the Chamber's annual project, had taken ill. And somebody who has to this day remained nameless volunteered me to become Santa Claus. Now, I can tell you, when you're setting up a law practice and you've got a family that's just started, the last thing I needed was that kind of distraction bordering on an annoyance. But they were persistent, and I thought, well, I'll do it and get it done, do my civic duty, and get it over with. After all, how much difficulty can there be to put on a red and white suit, some wig and whiskers, and repeat ho, ho, ho to children, ask them what they'd like for Christmas, and then move on to the next kid? So I took on the role. Begrudgingly and with somewhat of a mild annoyance. That's how it got started.
Now, you were attorney at this time, right?
I was a practicing attorney and a trial attorney, and as you mentioned, probably the candidate for the poster boy for every bad lawyer joke ever told.
So you weren't the nicest gentleman in the world, is that what you're saying?
Oh, that's about right.
Okay.
Got that one. So what happened is... I was sent to do the Santa Claus bit at the town's community center, where a room had been set aside, festooned with Santa memorabilia, harnesses for the reindeer, whatever. And I was detailed to dress for the role in, of all places, the girls' locker room. One is kind of nervous about entering a girls' locker room, and I pounded loudly on the door and hoping to actually be turned away, found no one inside, and very carefully examined the whole room, announcing my presence that each time I turned a row of lockers or moved in so I didn't encounter some child. You can imagine the concern where the newspaper headlines reads, lawyer exposes self to sixth grade girls while I'm dressing. I was kind of nervous. And I verified that room was empty of any human beings. I then began to open the cardboard box and for the first time don my Santa suit. Where I was getting dressed, Chris, was in front of a mirror that basically prevented anyone from entering or exiting the room without my knowing. I was just back to that very same community center a couple weeks ago to do a charity show, and the room hasn't changed a bit, and I recall exactly where I was. And I was finishing adjusting my wig and whiskers and my makeup when behind me, from inside the room, appeared a fully dressed, absolutely perfect Mrs. Claus. I should have known something was wrong at that moment, because there was no way she could have gotten past me, and I can absolutely assure you she wasn't in the room when I began the Christmas metamorphosis into Santa Claus.
How do you think she got there?
I have no idea to this day, but as I mentioned in the book, I was so nervous about my impending role that I was distracted from focusing on it. To this very day, I still have no idea. In fact, when I was back there a couple weeks ago, I really looked at the room with a perspective of some dozen years or so and still found myself totally at a loss to explain how she got there. It turned out her name was Ann Shear. And she had been portraying Mrs. Claus for a number of years throughout the area. She was a resident of the city of Grafton, which is a sister city to Cedarburg, Wisconsin. You actually can't tell them apart. You drive from one to the other. And unknown to me, she was rather well-known in the area, and actually had achieved some regional prominence for her portrayal of Mrs. Claus.
Okay. Now, you all, at that point, after you met this Anne, I assume you all then immediately went in to meet with the children and so forth.
That's
right.
And
how did that feel to you at that time?
Well, Anne gave me some instructions. And the most important thing that she told me when she put the hat, the Santa cap on my head, was that it's all in the cap. And she made a few adjustments to the costume. And we walked out onto the community floor, which was being used as a basketball court at the time. And I was somewhat taken aback. There was a basketball game going on, and we stopped the game in almost mid-flight of the ball. And I realized that the appearance of Santa Claus has a profound effect on people of all ages. Mm-hmm. And it was then that I realized that there's quite a bit of obligations that come with putting on that red and white suit. And although a bit nervous, Anne escorted me across the floor and in the back door to the room where we would go to meet the children. And as I say, the room was completely decorated to look like a tremendous scale model of Santa's home at the North Pole. And I seated myself in a large throne-like chair to receive the children. And Anne stood behind me. And all during that afternoon, she offered gentle guidance and gave me information about what was going to happen, essentially on-the-job training.
Okay. And when did it occur to you that you were beginning to feel a little different, that, you know, this was affecting you in more of a way than you actually expected it to?
Well, it didn't really start immediately, but the program that we presented ran from about 1 o'clock until 4, although it wasn't unusual in later years for it to go as long as there were children waiting to see Santa Claus, and that sometimes meant it went as late as 5:30, 6, even 6:30. During that day, I began to notice that Anne seemed to have almost a natural knowledge about the children coming into the room. Now, as a local resident, I'm sure many of them were known to her because she knew the families. She did a lot of charity work.
Sure.
But some of them were total strangers. Cedarburg's a very popular tourist destination, and we had families coming from states as far away as Ohio. A lot of people from the Chicago area come to visit. And these people could not have been known to her. And yet she would say something to me to mention to the child or ask the child or respond to the child. And in the first year, I guess I was just so amazed by this knowledge. I never really focused upon it or thought too much about it. I just kind of wanted to get through the role and not embarrass myself or do anything that might harm a child's, you know, visit with Santa Claus.
So she was actually picking up things about each individual child there, that some of which, as you just mentioned, she did not even know.
I'm going to use the word advertently, and I'm going to say that some of the things she did, I think, bordered on the clairvoyant.
Okay.
And you know, as a trial lawyer, I heard a lot of stories about a lot of explanations how things did or didn't happen. Uh-huh. I'm probably one of the classic skeptics walking the face of God's green earth. And this was all very, very mysterious to me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just stood there and it kind of went along with the game, so to speak.
Now, I understand that you all spent many years together doing this.
Right. I had planned only to do it that first year because we had experienced the birth of our first child, and I thought, well, it'll be a nice photo op. I'll just do it. I'll do my civic duty, and I'll get on with making money. Sort of a lawyer-like attitude towards
sure.
it. You know? When we parted that night, I watched Anne walk across the snow-covered parking lot and get into a rather dilapidated automobile, which I was pleased to see start so I wouldn't have to do the old jump start trick. And I thought, my gosh, you know, when she was out of the room, she looked as ordinary as you or I. Mm-hmm. But in character, she became almost magical. I got into my car, drove home, and I do recall that I did glance out the windshield, and it was just a beautiful night, early December evening, and it was crystal clear. And I looked at the stars, and I thought, what a beautiful night. And I said to myself, it's a great night for flying. probably just the kind Santa would like. And I think at that moment, although I didn't realize it, I was hooked. We would do this for another 12 years. Every year we renewed the role, and our seasonal reprise became more and more complete. In about the seventh year, a gentleman had come from New York City, and he had come to offer us a rather extravagant sum to come to New York and do Mr. and Mrs. Claus for a commercial presentation over the holiday period in New York City. Mm-hmm. We, of course, declined, not because it wasn't of interest to it. It's just that we knew that if whatever we ever did for money, it would be kind of like stepping over a line, and the mystery that attended our presentation was such that it would vanish. And, of course, as you know, tragedy began to overtake us, and Anne began to suffer from a serious illness. And in 1990, we lost Anne. And that was the last time that I ever put on the red and white suit. But little did I know what would happen following upon Anne's death and what would come to visit itself upon me that continues to this very day.
Now, you say you stopped basically dressing up as Santa Claus each year after Anne passed away?
That's right. Interestingly, what happened is, and I think you notice this in the book, Anne was tragically taken from us in an automobile accident that occurred in spring of 1990. The accident occurred at an intersection which was not too far from where my law office was located. I knew about the accident because I was up in the wee hours of the morning. Sorry to say, I wasn't listening coast to coast. I was preparing some last-minute tax papers and heard of the accident, and I was disturbed because it bothered me. It was so close to my office. And I thought, at least it can't involve any of my staff because it was way too early in the morning. But I was bothered by the location because something was wrong with that accident. And it was at an intersection that is so clear out in the country that you can't imagine somebody could have an accident. You could see for a million miles in each direction. I went into the office, tended to my regular affairs, and went down to try a case in Milwaukee, came back. And I came back the long way to go through that intersection because I was still bothered about that accident. And I drove through the intersection. It was almost intact. I couldn't see anything but maybe a little piece of glass. I thought, my gosh, how could somebody have had a fatal accident? Anyway, I stopped at the office, checked my papers, and then went home. That night when I got home, a phone call came from the Chamber of Commerce president, and he said that he had some bad news for me. He asked if I had heard about Anne, and I said no. And he said, well, Anne has passed away. And before he could go another word, I said she was in the auto accident at the intersection that I identified specifically. And he was taken aback by it. And he said, how'd you know? And I said, I knew something the moment I heard it about that. I kept that information from my family that night, because that night was the night before the next day, which would be my birthday. And I didn't want to tell the children that.
Right.
So I kept it in my heart, celebrated my birthday with a heavy heart, and the day after told my children, who both knew Anne very, very well, of her passing.
Now, you and Anne had become obviously very close over that long 12 years.
We were married for two weekends a year for 12 years. And even though we were in residence of cities next to each other, we never seemed to run into each other, you know, at the Kmart or the gas station or whatever. And we only found each other on the two weekends that we worked as Mr. and Mrs. Claus for the children of the Midwest. And we shared many things after the afternoon's performance, and we exchanged many, many intimacies that only matters of the heart between two very, very close friends would allow them to speak to one another. But we never spoke during the year. We never exchanged any kind of letters or communications. We just met for this kind of Shangri-La type experience the two weekends immediately before Christmas. Each year.
So you think possibly then she was actually speaking to you then to let you know what had happened to her and where it had happened?
I definitely felt that to be the case. And as a skeptic, it was a little bit of an unnerving experience. Not quite as unnerving as what would happen in the cemetery the following Christmas.
I want to get to that next after this break. We're talking with Bob Lytak. I'm Chris McGill, filling in for vacationing George Norrie, and you're listening to Coast AM. And as we are in the week of Christmas time, I'm talking with Bob Lytak, a trial lawyer from Wisconsin who believes he has Santa Claus's spirit. He has basically become Santa Claus. We'll continue our discussion with Bob Lytak next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast AM. I'm Chris McGill, filling in for the vacationing George Norrie. Our guest this hour, Bob Lytak, who had a miraculous transformation in his life after taking the job as a Santa Claus several years ago. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Chris.
As we left for the last break, we were talking about the Lady Anne, who played Mrs. Claus with you all of these years, and the very mysterious circumstances around you actually being notified of her death in what you believe to be a clairvoyant way, correct?
Absolutely. But the mystery deepened the following Christmas.
And we do have, by the way, a picture of Anne's tombstone up on the Coast to Coast website, and you can get that at coasttocoastam.com. Tell me the full story now, Bob.
Okay, this is where it really got the plot thickens, as they say, Chris. As I said, we lost Anne in spring of 90, and the pain had eased a little bit, but the wound reopened when the holidays came around in December. And as I mentioned earlier, Anne had always told me it's the cap that makes the Santa, and the cap is something magical to Santa. I went on the last Saturday before Christmas, when Anne and I would traditionally conclude our Christmas sojourn, to the cemetery where she was buried. It was, and I went at just about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, knowing that a few miles to the west, at the community center, another Santa Claus and another Mrs. Claus were seeing children. And it was a cold and bitter day. There was some small snow flurries biting, and I parked my car on a slight incline and walked up to the tombstone, and I left my Santa cap atop the tombstone and said a quiet prayer on Anne's behalf, because I knew that the person who had held many, many infants, sometimes only a couple days old, as children brought them to visit with Santa Claus for the first time, was now herself being held by the infant himself in a far better place. As I mentioned in the book, I brought to mind a story that where I felt I had been kind of pinned on a Christmas pincushion, and yet somehow some words that were not of my own choosing came to me, and I managed to wiggle out of a rather tight spot. I don't know on that day if it was the wind or maybe just memories, but a little bit of a mist came over my eyes, and I thought back of the 12 years and returned to my car and went home. That was Saturday. Sometime that night, perhaps early Sunday morning, it occurred to me that I had foolishly left my cap there, and it was the only thing I had to remember the 12 wonderful years we'd spent together, and as touching and loving as it might have been, I decided that I had done the wrong thing and I would recover it. And I peeped out the window, and I noticed a raging snowstorm was going on, and I thought, well, I can wait till morning and the plows come through. I lived a little bit out in the country, and it would be a little bit of a difficult drive. So at first light, I bundled myself up and I think started my car slipping and sliding its way to the cemetery. And the cemetery is on a state highway at the edge of the city where Anne lived. And her tombstone is visible right from the highway. And I was the first person down the road. And I had a high-powered sports car at that time and was a little worried I was going to get stuck in the cemetery. So I pulled in just enough off the highway to get my car safely out of harm's way, and the lawyer in me taking, you know, appropriate care and
right.
concern. And by now the snow had stopped, and there was a 4 to 6 inches of new fallen snow on the ground, and I trudged a few feet up the hill to Ann's tombstone and started with my shoe and boot kicking the snow aside because I noticed the cap wasn't on the tombstone, and I assumed it had blown off. And so I started kicking a path 2 or 3 feet wide around the tombstone, and I couldn't find the cap. Now, what I'm telling you, Chris, I did not put in the book when I wrote it 6 years ago. In fact, when Ann passed away in 90, it took me 8 years of dealing with the event I'm about to relate to you to work up the courage to even tell somebody. I was really worried if I put it in the book, they would probably put me in a rubber room and lift my law license. Because when you're a person that deals with facts and realities, as lawyers do, when you're confronted with something that's wholly inexplicable, as that which I'm about to relate, you really do come face to face with the most sacred and innermost beliefs that you hold. At the tombstone, I worked my way around the circle of tombstone looking for the cap and couldn't find it. And I was terribly distressed. And I thought maybe someone had taken it and I wouldn't find it at all. And I was certain that I had checked the ground carefully because even little pieces of grass were, blades of grass were sticking up. And as you look at the photo, that photo was taken from the west side of the tombstone. I was now around to the east side of the tombstone, the side I couldn't see when I pulled in. And my glance was drawn to the base of the tombstone, which is the flat part before the right angle perpendicular part of the stone rises from it. And I saw there a plate with 2 Christmas cookies and a piece of bubblegum. And I thought to myself, how lovely. Somebody had remembered
right.
and brought Ann the cookies. Now, one of the magic things that Ann told me is that Rudolph liked bubblegum. And in the book, as I recount, we made a big deal out of telling the children to leave celery and carrots for the reindeer,
mm-hmm.
Prancer, Dancer, and the whole group.
Right.
But Rudolph likes bubblegum. And it was yeah. wonderful to have the kids tell us bubblegum because we knew we were having an impact on the children. I thought, wonderful, somebody knows a story. And I picked up the plate, and I was looking at it, and my glance was drawn to the circle of footprints that I had made around the tombstone. And I noticed that on the plate, there was no snow, not a flake. And it occurred to me.
So it had been placed there after the snowfall then?
Yes, but there were no footprints other than mine leading to the tombstone. There is no way any mortal person could have placed that remembrance on Anne's tombstone without having left visible evidence of their presence. Chris, I know we're on mm-hmm. national radio. I hate to tell you this, but my immediate problem at that point was bladder control. I was terrified. You can't imagine how a person who deals with harsh realities, as a trial lawyer does, to be confronted with facts that turn the physical universe upside down.
Now, was that the only incident of that nature that has happened while you were there?
That's the only thing that happened at the cemetery. But it was the beginning of things which would happen to me every year since. And they've gone on and on and on to this very day.
Are you talking just what you believe to be possibly paranormal incidents around? Is it just around Christmas time? Or
it's only at Christmas. My personal belief is that there's a force in the world for good, which is focused at this particular time of year, and it takes shape. I sometimes think it may even materialize to mm-hmm. represent a person. I was looking during the break at your next guest, Joan Anderson's website, mm-hmm. and I noticed she had a story about a tow truck driver who materialized to pull her son out of a death-threatening snowstorm.
Right.
And something similar to that has occurred with me. And I'm sure that you have listeners out there who've had the same type of events occur over the holiday season, things which are otherwise inexplicable and have somehow a relationship to the love and joy and charity that attends the Christmas season.
Now, all these years you spent with Ann, obviously, as we've discussed, you had a very close relationship with her, and you believe you've had some connection with her, some communication with her. since she's been passed on.
Absolutely.
Now, is she the main reason you believe, and let me ask you first, do you believe that you have taken on the spirit of Santa Claus through these years?
I believe I've been gifted with more knowledge than any one person is entitled to have about the spirit of Santa Claus. Do I believe that Santa Claus flies around the world in a sleigh and leaves Christmas gifts? No.
Okay.
But do I believe that Santa Claus exists to do things? Yes. Do I believe that sometimes he may physically materialize? Yes. Could I take but a moment to tell you what happened in Arizona to prove that point?
Sure, and I want to take this moment, too, to remind the listeners, too, you can call in with your Christmas or Santa stories if you've had anything miraculous like this happen to you around the Christmas holidays. If you're east of the Rockies, it's 800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, 800-618-8255. Your first-time caller line is 1-818-501-4721. And the wildcard line is 818-501-4109. Tell me that story, Bob.
Let me just take you back 2 years. It's actually the same time as it is right now, calendar-wise. We're here in Arizona, and friends of mine have moved from Wisconsin to Arizona, and they are in the process of acquiring a home. The Sunday before this evening, which would be Tuesday, they lost their dog, a loving family friend, family friend. A very heartache type of situation occurred. Any animal lover, pet lover will immediately understand the sadness that had befallen them.
Definitely.
The dog they had was a Samoyed. That's one of those great big white husky type dogs, very, very infrequently encountered in the warm climes of Arizona, and not likely to be replaced. I went with them on a Tuesday afternoon to look at a home not too far from where I live, basically to get out of the house and get their minds off what had happened. And we went into the home, and it was on a cul-de-sac, you know, a very nice house. And I went in and with my friend and his wife and met the realtor, and we're looking around. And they liked the home very much, and it was pretty obvious they were probably going to make an offer on it. So I stepped outside with my friend to do the guy thing, you know, look at the yard, how much cleaning there is, check the roof, et cetera. And we stepped back in the cul-de-sac to get a look at this house, a perspective. And approaching us from behind was a gentleman with some rather bushy white whiskers and a large flowing silver mane, and he was dressed very casually in some very nice slacks and shoes, and he was leading a Samoyed. And he came up and he inquired my friend if they were interested in the home, and my friend said yes they were. And he said, you'll love it here. He said, we've lived here since the subdivision was built. You'll just love it. He made some comments about subdivision. And then he closed by saying he was sorry that he was going to be leaving, and even more sorry that where they were going, he and his wife, they wouldn't be able to take the dog, and he was looking for a home for his Samoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Coincidence? It gets
maybe.
Worse. It gets
maybe.
Worse.
We do have someone on the line. Let's go to the first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast AM.
Hello?
Hello. Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm a caller from Texas. It's been a few years ago, but a friend of mine, we had a Christmas tree lot that we opened up down in, I live in Central Texas, and one night on Christmas Eve, there was a young lady that come onto this lot late at night. It was about 10:30 or 11 o'clock. I guess she might have been in her middle 20s or so, and she was dressed real peculiar, like something out of the 20s or early 30s, and she was requesting a small tree. And we had just a few trees left, and she was wanting one really small, like 3 foot or so. And we just decided we were going to let her have one and told her to go pick one out. And she went and picked one out, come back and brought it to us, and we just told her, you know, just to go ahead and take it. And she said, well, the children will just be thrilled to death over this. And all that. We said that was nice. And we just, both of us just turned our back for just a second. And when we turned around, I mean, an eye blink, she was gone. Disappeared, vanished.
That's fascinating.
That's
how did that make you feel?
I mean, just, it was no way that she could walk away that quick, plus with all the open area that we were in. I mean, it was just like like the twinkle of your eye. You turn around and you look and she's gone.
Words well chosen.
I'm sorry?
Words well chosen, a twinkle of an eye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just telling you, it was just, and I've told several people about this, and to this day yet, I think it's something that's burning my mind, and I just thought it was just unexplainable. I just said it did happen, and I wasn't able to really get a hold of it. And it really didn't frighten me. It just kind of left me feeling really kind of mellow about things, you know, after it happened.
Chris, what comes to me from the caller's description of the lady's dress, he places it in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
That could put that person in the Depression, when the price of a Christmas tree might be more than a family could have afforded. Is it
That's
possible
true.
Somebody completed their Christmas quest on this gentleman's tree lot?
It's very possible, I guess.
That's what I hear.
You know,
so it's come
a lot of miracles happen around this time of year. Now, Bob, I know recently you've pursued your dream of doing a lot for children. You're not, you know, playing the Santa role necessarily.
I'm a sucker when it comes to kids' charities.
And what are you doing about the Christmas bears?
One of the best-kept secrets is that Ann and I had always wanted to build some bears for children. Ann had a love of bears. And I spent a long time trying to build some bears, a very special bear. You know, I heard you mention it. You've got a show coming up with Gladys McCants, the numbers lady.
Mm-hmm.
I've got one for her on my bears. We invested quite a bit in building some bears to follow Ann's dream. I was dedicated to it. And to my company, we found that the bears did not arrive as scheduled. We had purchased a bunch of bears, about 5,000 or more. We had some very irate retail customers who were expecting bears in late August, September, November, October, and they didn't even arrive in December. We got a call from the shipper that the bears arrived on Christmas Eve. I told the gentleman, bring them the day after Christmas. We weren't going to be able to do much with those bears on Christmas Eve. Expecting to find 5,000 bears last year, we unpacked the boxes, which were various sizes, and found out instead of 5,000 bears or so, we only got 1,225 bears. And we were really kind of depressed. And then one of the people who was helping me said, wait a minute, 1,225 is the numerical equivalent for Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm.
And the other elf said, wait a minute. You see, we're building a bear with each letter of the alphabet. Each one has a name that starts with a letter of the alphabet, because bears actually work at the North Pole. There are 26 letters of the alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
We were unpacking those bears on the 26th of December. I said to my friends assembled helping me, this is a message. This is a message from Anne. This is a message from Angel Wings. We are meant to build 26 bears in additions of no more than 1,225. And we have now changed our business to build just that many bears, 26 bears in additions of 1,225 to commemorate that particular desire that Ann had to build bears. And I think that there's a message in how that happened. You know, people can say, hey, it's coincidence. I'll say something else. But can I finish the Samoyed story?
Yes, please do.
The gentleman pressed the Samoyed's leash into my friend's hand, and he went back up the driveway into his house. My friend and I went into the house, and his wife said, she said, I love this. I really like to write on this. My friend said, it's a great house. It comes with a Samoyed. And she started to get tears, and he started to get tears. They said to the broker, write up the offer. We're going to thank the gentleman. I went with them outside down the driveway and up the driveway. We'd seen the man proceed to his house.
Uh-huh.
My friend knocked on the door. The wife answered, and he said, we want to thank you for giving us this dog. Your husband, my wife would like to thank him. She looked at us incredulously and said, we don't have any such dog. He described her husband. She said, there's no such person that lives on this cul-de-sac. We've lived here since it was built.
That's an amazing story. Amazing story. Bob Lytak, thank you for joining us this first hour of Coast to Coast. I've had a very good time talking with you, and I wish you the best and the merriest of Christmases.
And a Merry Christmas to you, Chris.
Thank you so much. We're going to talk with author Joan Wester Anderson next about true angelic encounters. I'm Chris McGill, filling in for George Norrie, and you're listening to Coast AM.